Welcome to GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I'm your host, Megan Bull.
And I'm your co-host, Scott Walters.
And Scott, do you know what audiology is?
I've heard of it, and you know, right away I think like, oh, of course I do, but I don't actually. I think it's like basically the study of how we help people hear.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking of some business back when I was a kid, and their motto was turn up the volume of life. So I assume it has to do with hearing at the very least.
One of my best friend's father is an audiologist and he's a doctor, but I don't really know all the details of what he does.
Well, we're with someone who does know what audiology is. We're here today with our GradCast producer, newest member, Maria Khan.
Hello, hello. What is up? How's everybody doing?
And Maria, do you want to start us off by telling us what you research and what you do?
Yes. Yeah, so my program, I'm a master's program, Master of Clinical Science in Audiology. And the great question, what audiology is, if you want to break it, the Greek word down, audio is sound and logy is a study of, which is not really helpful. But basically audiology, the most broadest sense is we help with your hearing and balance disorders and everything in between. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is audiology? I'm going to ask that question again.
Yes. So that's what it is. But basically what an audiologist does, if that would help
that would
provide context. Basically, we help manage, diagnose, treat disorders of hearing as well as disorders of balance. So if somebody has a hearing loss, we help with that. Somebody has vertigo or any balance-related issues, we help with that because our inner ear system basically is also related to hearing and balance. That's why we somebody comes in, we're like, oh, you got balance problems, we can fix that. We help with amplification of hearing. So like Scott mentioned, hearing aids, that is something we do. We provide and dispense hearing aids. So somebody's having trouble hearing things in noisy environments, for example, we can provide hearing aids and we can program them to make sure, oh, if like in a noisy environment, it'll go, the volume or the gain will get a little higher so you can hear better. We help with other assistive devices like bone-anchored hearing aids and cochlear implants. We help with the basically the process of, do you need them, yes or no, and then all the way to your surgery, because those do get implanted depending on which one you're getting. And what else do we do? And also we help with counseling. So hearing is not just you hear, because you hear with the sound comes in through your ears, but then you process everything with your brain. And sometimes people with hearing loss have difficulties like trying to hear again in noisy environments is a really common concern we get. So we can counsel like, hey, you can use assistive technologies like remote microphones, you can use you know, make sure you're looking at people in the eye and the face when they're talking, good lighting, making sure you can see, not missing any cues when people are speaking. So that's another thing we can help with, is the more how to do things rather than like prescribing things, because hearing aids again is really big thing of what audiologists do, but it's just more than that, because that's a common misconception I would say, is like, oh, y'all only do hearing aids. No, we do so much more than that.
Well, that's interesting because, yeah, hearing aids in and of itself you described as so much, and there's so much more than that. So you're in this master's program you were just talking about. So in your program, does it sort of do more of a broad coverage of all the topics to a certain depth, or does it sort of specialize in a given area of audiology?
That is a great question. So we look at everything at like a, not at a surface level, but not at a really like large in-depth either. It's more like we cover everything, and if you want to specialize in something, then that's something you can do, like talk to your professors, get more information, be a part of research if that's your thing. But basically how our program works is we're a two-year master's program and we are course-based, so we do courses, way too many in one term in my humble opinion. Like last term we had like 9 courses, labs and all that fun stuff, losing our heads, but we got through. And and we also have clinical experiences. So like this term I'm in clinic right now, tomorrow I have clinic, so we get to see patients and stuff. And basically what our program's goal is, get enough clinical hours, clinical experiences, and learn the competencies that an audiologist needs to know that are highlighted by our regulatory college. So the College of Audiologists and Speech Language Pathologists of Ontario. And then after that, once we get our 350 hours, we can write a competency exam. We pass that, yay, audiologists, you can practice. So that's basically the whole goal of our program, is to make sure we can practice afterwards.
Okay, so you kept giving me a list of all the things audiologists do, like, oh, what else are we doing? Oh, we're doing this, or we're doing this. And you said you had 9 courses, which is nuts, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah,
it is. Do you want to, what were they? Like, do you mind walking us through the types of courses
so
you asked to do?
Yeah, so in first term, if you want to break it down, we had our, I guess our course about audiology, basically, like applications of audiometry. So we learn about what tests do audiologists do and how to do them, Like, for example, when we want to do a hearing test, what does that look like? You give somebody a clicker. You're like, you're going to hit this button every time you hear a sound. And then basically the sound gets lower and lower in volume. And then by the time you can't hear it, you hear the softest sound. That's threshold. So basically that's one of the tests we learn in that course is hearing test, a basic one that I should know how to do by now. We'll see once I get to clinic if I know how. Other ones are more of our physics-related courses. Fun fact, I forgot that sound is related to physics coming into audiology, which I laughed so hard when I sat in my physics class. I'm like, ha ha, sound is... Anyway, it was really funny. And so that one is talking more about the electricity and like how sound waves work, because it's important to know, because if, say, for example, you're in a sound booth, sound waves travel and it can be impacted by the shape of the room, and it may not be a good area to do hearing tests, for example. We learn about circuits and electricity because hearing aids and the device we work with are made out of electrical components. Our sound booths, all the really expensive equipment we have in clinic, are all just wires all put together, and it's more complicated than that, but we have to learn how to calibrate. We have to know when something goes wrong, how to fix that. So those are like the basis of our physics courses. What else did we do? In those courses, we have labs. So like we get hands-on clinical practice. So like we practice on each other how to put like ear tips in the ear so we can do a test, how to put different transducers on. So for example, there's like a metal headband that we use for bone conduction, and because there is a lot of vibration from like sound to like bone mechanics, like in your middle ear, and then it goes to your cochlea and all the inner hair cells and whatever. So we have to make sure that, oh, is that somebody's middle ear system working? So that's why we do bone conduction. What else did we do? I'm trying to think. But yeah, that's the gist of it, where like we learn about the theory and we learn how to put it in practice.
No, that's really super interesting.
Yeah.
And then putting it in practice in the after. You talked about the College of Audiologists and Speech Language
yes,
Pathologists
yes.
of Ontario.
CASLPO for
yeah, okay, I was gonna ask if there was an acronym. Okay. So when you are certified, so is that the term? Like now you're an audiologist, because you're not an MD, for instance, but like is there like what are your letters, and then what is the main things you would like what are the main things you think you're going to want to do? Do you know that yet? Do you have an idea of where you're wanting to go?
Wonderful question. So yeah, we would be registered with our regulatory body. So like our acronym will literally be our name and then the CASLPO afterwards. So they know that we are registered and that the regulatory body is happy with what we have, and that, oh, we're competent enough to practice is essentially what it is. And for me, I want to be a cochlear implant audiologist because my younger brother has two cochlear implants. So like that's how I got exposed to the field in the first place. Because again, every time I meet somebody, oh, what's audiology? And I'm like, such a good question. Let me tell you about it. But yeah, that's what I want to focus on. So like, this relates to the research stuff that I was involved in. Want to segue into that?
Yeah, why not? Actually, while we're on that topic, what is a cochlear implant specialist?
Yeah, so for cochlear implants, what it is. So like I said earlier, the cochlea is somewhere where we have these hair cells that basically take the electrical information that was sound to electrical information and takes it to the brain, in I guess the most basic way I can describe it. And sometimes with people who have hearing loss, those hair cells don't work anymore. Mm-hmm. And if the cochlea is still intact, they can surgically, they'll put an electrode through the cochlea so it can artificially stimulate it. So instead of the hair cells being like, we're action potentialing, whatever, that's not even a word, but we are working, the electrode will instead stimulate it and then send the sound wave or sound information to the brain. Mm-hmm. So since my brother has them, like, it's a really cool technology because like 25-30 years ago, this stuff was really new. Mm-hmm. So it's really like how cochlear implants develop is really quick. So I just thought this field is so cool. I wouldn't mind specializing in it. But yeah, in terms of the research stuff related to cochlear implants, or got my first, I guess, start in research at SickKids, the Hospital of Sick Children, because again, my brother goes there for his cochlear implant stuff, and I'm like, oh, they have a research lab here. Let me just give them a really quick email, and the PI was like, hey, you're cool. Come on in. And I'm like, okay, cool. So basically for, I don't know, is it 2 to 3 years, I just been like an RA or student research assistant person, and I just help out in lab when needed. Usually my focus was data collection, so I would help out in lab doing EEG collection as well as auditory brainstem response, ABR collection. And I just have to distract the kids, especially if they're younger, to make sure they don't move too much and mess up the data we collect and other stuff they need me to do. Yeah.
So when you're there and what you're doing and the audiologist that you're working with, learning from, I get the impression the audiologist then, because they're not doctors, they're not installing, they're not actually, you know, surgically implanting them. But you, so is it that you're working with the patient and you're able to diagnose how well it's working and make the adjustment, and you kind of provide the ongoing continuous care for this person over time to make sure,
Yeah, basically, because we would be working before they get implanted, so in the candidacy process, because not everybody gets a cochlear implant because those are really expensive devices, and like we have to make sure this person has, like, again, the like the physiology itself is available for available, but it's like can take the electrode, because you have to get MRIs done to make sure structure is there. Okay, great, structure is there. And then the ENT audiologist and the whole team would like work together to be like, okay, is their home environment good? Like, do they have support at home? How is their education looking like? Like, are they able to enter, like, enter back into like their school, for example, and be able to hear their peers, hear their teacher? It's basically not just like in the candidacy process, not just, oh, you have hearing loss, yes or no, okay, yay, surgery. It's like looking at the entire child itself, which I think is really cool. And so they would work before implantation. After implantation, we would activate or turn on the devices, and then we would adjust if needed the programming. And then basically, like you said, we would follow, like in sick kids or pediatric world, for example, we'd follow them from the age they got implanted or before then till they till 18. And then afterwards they go to their big boy audiologist. Yeah.
No, that's super interesting, because it's not, audiology doesn't seem to be just about hearing. It's about the entire lifestyle and life conditions of the child
that
in that
case.
That
is the goal. Yeah.
And that kind of goes back to something I know we might have talked about before you got here, but you mentioned EEGs in your clinical experience, in your volunteer experience. Yeah. And I'm a little surprised at that, because I always considered the EEG a neurology brain science tool. So how does that kind of work into audiology and what you're doing?
Yeah, so currently this term we're taking an electrophysiology course. I was literally just yelling about it before the recording, where I was doing an assignment where I'm looking at auditory brainstem responses. So they're just brainwaves, and we have to label them and et cetera. And where the EEG comes in is we have to make sure when we are like collecting data from the patient that their signal is not noisy, because if you blink, speak, move, because we put electrodes on their head to like collect the data basically, and if you do all that stuff, it's going to add to like the activity that the electrodes collect, and so it's not really conducive to, oh, we can interpret this brainwave, because if it's noisy all over the place, we can't really be like, okay, you have, your hearing should be good or your hearing is not good. So like we can't use a noisy signal basically, and then the EEG makes sure we can see the patient's nice and calm. We can, okay, we can go on and collect data, is where the EEG would come in. And the ABR itself, the auditory brainstem response, we are looking at everything beyond the cochlea to the auditory cortex in the brain. And so each like wave or bump in the wave will be a certain area of the brainstem and then the brain. And then that's how we can help with the diagnosis of certain hearing disorders. Like if you have a retrocochlear, so behind the cochlear pathology, then we can be like, oh, you may have a schwannoma, for example, like a tumor in your myelin of the neurons that are related to the auditory system. We could like help. It helps with differential diagnosis, basically.
Okay, yeah. No, that's super cool.
Yeah.
That's super interesting.
Yeah. Oh, we also use ABRs for the infant hearing program, which, ding, ding, relates back to some research I'm doing. But for infants, for newborns, in the hearing screening program, we do an ABR to see, like, quickly, does this infant, can they hear, yes or no? And because, again, infants are not going to be like, okay, press the button, and every time you hear a beep, they literally cannot do that. So the ABR is an objective way of seeing their hearing status, basically.
Okay.
And then relating back to the research I'm currently doing as a graduate student assistant, if I remember my lab correctly, the pediatric audiology systems and strategies lab. So there I'm currently working on a cost analysis for the infant hearing program to see how effective it is cost-wise to doing these screenings, as well as looking at social determinants of health for hearing like in infants. And basically social determinants of health are factors outside of like your, how do I describe, like factors that basically influence health, like income, for example, your education status, gender, etc. So everything we're looking at right now,
like socioeconomic status. Okay.
Okay, it's very cool. Well, that explanation really helps me understand a bit more about why this would be related to like motion and, mm-hmm. and balance as well, because yeah. you're looking at the actually like electrical system back mm-hmm. there and how all of it's working together. Yeah. And yeah, you were saying that's in there too. So yeah. that's really cool. You also mentioned a lot about the infants mm-hmm. And you know, working with children. And I know that's what you're doing with yeah. your research. When you want to go on in the future and work with cochlear implants, are you mm-hmm. looking to be somebody who specializes with younger people, or mm-hmm. Are you thinking you're going to want to kind of branch out to like the full age audience?
It's a great question, because in terms of for schooling, we have to hit all the age demographics. Right. So your adults, older adults, children, infants, etc., to make sure we have enough hours for our regulatory body to be like, oh, hey, great job, you're competent. But for myself, I do want to work and specialize in pediatrics, because kids are just fun to work with.
They can be, yes.
They can be, and also they can't be, but I just like, because basically as somebody who works with pediatrics, for the most part, you're going to be following them from their babies or infants or children to all the way to up to 18. And I think it's really special to be a part of like their journey from like little mm-hmm. baby to adult. You know, I think that's pretty cool to be a part of.
That is cool.
You know, you remind me of when I was a child, I didn't go through sick kids, but I went through like the McMaster mm-hmm. Children's Hospital yeah. for epilepsy. And that's what they did, was they followed you from mm-hmm. like when I was a little kid to when I aged out, yeah. when I was a big girl. And I find that really interesting. And I would love to ask you the question I would have liked to ask the researchers who were following me, mm-hmm. which is like, what have you found with your research with infant screening programs,
yeah.
for example? Or like, what have you found so mm-hmm. far?
Wonderful question. Nothing, because we're very early on into the cost analysis, because we're currently designing like the design, like the decision pathway mm-hmm. or decision tree for, oh, somebody does do screening, then what? Somebody doesn't do screening, then what? So we're very early on into the cost analysis. Mm-hmm. We're still, like, last time I saw, we were looking at papers of, like, other cost analysis for, like, universal hearing screening or infant hearing screening. So currently nothing, because we're still trying to design which way people go in the screening pathway. So
would that screening be algorithmic? Apologize for my, because you described a decision mm-hmm. tree, so it
I
would
believe
be...
so. We're working with somebody from Ivy who like does cost okay. analysis stuff, because this is out of my domain, honestly. Money stuff, I'm like, I don't know what this is, but yeah, I'm assuming so, because based off the examples I saw, like the decision tree will help like figure like help us basically see where people are likely to go with screening, because not everybody gets screened. Mm-hmm. Some people fail out of screening, or not fail out, but aren't like followed up with screening. So like we have to basically account for all these different like pathways people take with hearing screening, and then we can figure out from there, is it cost effective, yes or no? And all the papers said it is cost effective, so we have hopes that the infant hearing screening in Canada, which is not in every province, by the way, it's some provinces have more fully fledged screening programs, other ones don't. And so because my PI, she basically grades these screening programs, be like, yes, good job, or no, you need to do better. So it'll basically help with her stuff to be like, okay, we need to tell this province, do this because it's cost effective and like it's mm-hmm. good for, you know, catching kids to make sure they don't enter school and they have a hearing difficulty. And we know that hearing loss, like as a child, can like impact speech development. It can impact how well they do in school. So it's really important to catch these kids like when they start learn how to speak, basically, because
yeah.
For most of us, we use hearing and speech as a way we communicate. And if you're in a family that uses speech and hearing and you cannot hear, it can cause a lot of difficulties growing yeah. up as a kid.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
Well, one thing I think is very incredible is you're interacting, like we all interact in our grad programs with people, of course, and we interact with people in our fields. But I think it's really incredible how many different diverse groups of people mm-hmm. you're interacting with. Your professors, of course, but also researchers and also their patients and yeah. the diversity of patients. Yeah. And so that's one thing that's really cool, that you have this experience working with them. I'm wondering, do you have any particular favorite stories? I know you can't reveal like personal yeah. details or anything, but any favorite stories of working with patients mm-hmm. or working with the research?
Yeah, that's a great question, because for school-wise, I literally started clinic a week ago and I saw a patient. So not much from there, but when I was at SickKids, I honestly like I'm trying to remember. I don't even have like a favorite like patient or favorite time I had with the patient, because I honestly found all of them really enjoyable, because each of the patients were unique. They came in because somebody has a cochlear implant on one side and they have normal hearing on the other side. Some kids come in like they have, again, both cochlear implants, so because that's what our cochlear implant lab, that's what we're looking at. But honestly, I just had like a good time just talking about the if they're older kids, we can talk about why are you here. Some of them are for high school hours to be able to like collect data from them. Like, oh, here's hours. Here you go. Have fun. But for the younger children, it's talking to the parents, and the parents are like, I understand how important research is, or they themselves are healthcare professionals. They're like, we know the importance of like research because this research can contribute to the development of other like programs and other like technologies in the future. Like, it may not benefit my child right now. Mm-hmm. But it'll benefit future kids, and I think that's pretty cool. So I just like all these interactions with parents who like understand. Obviously not all the parents who are in the room understand why we do research, and obviously informed consent, we have to explain what we're doing, but not all of them are gonna get it, and sometimes they can, you know, not be the most professional people to act with and interact with sometimes. Because they're like, why are we doing this? I mean, you signed up to be here, but whatever. But again, all of these like positive interactions I've had with children and with the parents, I just found like, I want to stay here. Like, I don't have like a favorite one because all of them have been really different. It's not like, oh my God, this one time it was, no, I don't. Unless my memory is really bad, which could also be it too.
Well, maybe you'll have a bit more of an answer for this one, which is what advice would you give someone who's entering your program?
Oh my God, good luck with first term. That's gonna like throw you out the window. But aside from that, because first term is very a lot compared to undergrad, have fun. You are not gonna know a lot of things in the beginning, and you're gonna feel like you're completely out of place, but you got into the program for a reason. There's only 32 of us in the program. It's a small program. It's competitive to get in. You got in for a reason. Give yourself that grace. You're gonna I still don't feel like I know anything, but we're in clinic, we're interacting with patients, we know something, it just doesn't feel like we do. So like, you will feel imposter syndrome, and that is okay.
And that's good advice to give.
Yeah.
Now, Maria, I know that you also volunteer with a group at U of T.
Yes.
Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So I'm also another research thingy I'm a part of is just help. I guess I'm around or what I am. I don't know what my role is. But I help out with the researching for LGBTQ plus health at U of T and CAMH. It's like a collaboration. And basically what we're doing there is a systematic review for arts-based research methods with like queer populations. So like we're doing a systematic review is literally, again, throwing myself out the window because it's a lot of work. Is it? Oh, I have to go through this many, too many papers, and I have to read through all of them in detail, and then you have to like pick apart the important stuff, and then you have to analyze. Literally, it's crazy. But yeah, we're just trying to see what arts-based research methods are used with the like queer like populations in the context of health, and like because a lot arts-based research methods aren't just like, oh, you're gonna do a photo voice. There's so many more than that. You can like put on a play. You can paint something, take pictures of things. You can interpret whatever art you want to, and that would be an arts, like an arts-based research method. And it's like, I'm just sitting there in these meetings. I'm like, I don't know what is going on. This is not my field. But why I'm there is because as somebody who is queer, I find it really important to have representation in research, because I was Googling, I'm like, where can I get involved for like queer-based research stuff? Because I'm like, I think it's important. And I found at U of T, and I'm like, let me give them another email. And the PI is like, welcome. And I'm like, way. So yeah, that's what I'm doing there.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Can you break down the arts-based methodology? I'm from that area.
Yes.
And I don't, well, I'm not from that area, but I'm close to that area. Yeah. I don't even know what that is.
I wish I could describe it. I really can't. Because every time we like try to, that's one of our questions is, what is our arts-based research method? And that's the one of them we want to answer from the systematic review, because this is qualitative, and using a quantitative type of systematic review approach may not really work. And that's what we're trying to figure out, whether the method of like taking all this data and like getting an answer from it, is that even going to be viable for what we're looking for? Because we're having discussions of like, oh, do we want to like do an arts-based research thing aside from your standard systematic review, just to make it more nuanced. But that is, again, one of the questions we're trying to answer, is what is an arts-based research method? Because it is so much more than just, oh, take a picture, analyze the picture, yay, we have data. It's so much more than that, from like what I have sat in meetings just silently listening to all these people who are PhDs in the field. They know what they're talking about. I don't. So I just sit there very quietly. I'm like, yes, I don't know what's going on.
What have you learned about it? If you've learned it all from these meetings, from sitting through it.
That it's so incredibly complex that, like, you know, I even sat here trying to think before, like, the recording. Yeah. I'm like, how do I describe this stuff? And I honestly don't know how to describe it. Because, again, you're straying away from your, like, qualitative research that follows, like, a pathway, for example. You, say, interviewing a patient, for example. You have your questions. You have, like, you know, they give you an answer. Then you can interpret the answer, whatever. Arts-based research methods, from what I've gathered, it's based off of the participant's interpretation of what's going on. So we can take a basic example, like a photo voice, where they take pictures of things, for example, that is meaningful for them. And then they can, like, break apart what's going on in the picture. And then the researcher will be like, okay, cool, we're going to take that. We're going to see if there's any trends happening. But then, again, is that still arts-based if you're using the scientific method on looking at pictures, right? So that's what we're trying to, like, see if what we're doing even makes sense.
That sounds very complex.
It is. Yeah, so we're trying to figure that out. Is this a bigger question mark is basically what the answer is.
Well, Maria, I know we don't have you for a ton of time longer, but one more thing I was hoping you'd tell us about, because you're busy doing a lot of things, is in addition to being one of our hosts here on GradCast, you've also been involved in another podcast having to do with your chosen major. And I was hoping you'd tell us just a little bit about what that one is, where people can hear about it, what you've done on it.
Yeah, so again, at SickKids at the Archie's Cochlear Implant Lab, I basically started this podcast from, like, nothing, from dust. I was like, okay, my PI is like, I want to do a podcast. Is that possible? I came in because I did YouTube, so, like, I've done, like, video editing. I'm like, oh, audio editing, that's no different, haha. That was me being a clown. Audio editing is similar enough, but also very different. But yeah, so in that podcast, my PI interviews other professionals in the field of audiology, like some of her coworkers from way back when, that, like, somebody who, like, was there when cochlear implants were being developed and being made, like, early career researchers. We were interviewed, the people behind the podcast, just to get to know how everything works. And I just edited the video. But yeah, that was my role, basically, just for, like, editing the podcast and getting it up. And my PI is like, yay, because it just took a while. Because we had to go through the whole transcribe everything. Yep. My PI goes through it to be like, remove this, remove that, remove this, add this in, whatever, the 1,000,005 edits we had to do. But then we got our final product and it's up. It's the Hear Hear podcast. We are at season 2 right now.
That's a good name.
Yeah, I know. I know, right? But yeah, that's essentially the podcast is looking at cochlear implant research at its, like, broad sense. So people who are new, who don't know much about the field, can listen to it and be like, oh, hey, like, I'm learning something. So basically the podcast is a tool for research communication. So, like, anybody who's in my shoes who wants to do audiology, somebody who's a parent and, like, wants to learn more about cochlear implant research, they can listen to the podcast and get more information, basically, is the whole goal of the podcast.
Okay, well, maybe we should put it in the show notes, I think, or link to it, to the Hear Hear podcast.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Sure we will. Well, thanks, Maria, for coming on the show. It's been great having you. This has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been your host, Scott Walters, and my co-host with Megan Voll, and we've been speaking with Maria Kahn. And this episode was produced by Emily Hutchinson. If you would like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, email us at gradcast@sogs.ca. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, and now also TikTok at GradCast Radio. To listen to us, we are on Radio Western at 94.9 FM, and you can also find all of our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.